From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The Southern Baptists vote on racism.
I think it's important that we take every opportunity to denounce and set ourselves apart from anything that is racist or that alienates our brothers and sisters in Christ who are people of color.
Whether that vote means anything and whether Michael Vick is like Michael Jordan, our Breakroom gang is going to talk about all that and more. But first, yesterday we talked about Georgians' worst driving habits, and we asked you to vent your road rage.
This is Edward Austin Hall calling from the gorgeous but automotively dangerous Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. Atlantans, you do not live in London. Please stay to the right side of the center line unless some city official is directing you to go around. People cross the center line to park on the left side of the street all the time, and guess what? It's illegal and it's dangerous. I almost got run over by somebody driving on the left side of the road.
Here are your first thoughts. Carly Cooper tweets, I hate when people in the left lane drive so fast, don't give you the chance to get over to the right lane, then come around you. So more complaints about lanes. Neil Cassidy says, we are the worst at using that little lever on the left of the steering wheel. Maybe the newer vehicles don't have one. And Joel Cook says, I have never seen so many people ignore stop signs and crosswalks. I've lived in New York, Florida, and South Carolina, and no one is worse than Georgia. Okay, so we don't stay in our lane and we don't use our turn signals and we don't stop at stop signs. Anything else? We want to hear what you think. You can call us, not while you're driving, at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Atlanta-based rapper Gucci Mane got out of prison last May. A month later, he released a new album and headlined at the Fox Theater. He's been busy over the past year, and this weekend he'll perform in Atlanta. I talked with Georgia-based hip-hop artist McConan and hip-hop scholar Regina Bradley about Gucci Mane's influence on hip-hop in the South. Regina was actually surprised we were even talking about Gucci Mane.
I still can't believe we're doing interviews about Gucci Mane on NPR.
I love that.
I can't believe it either. Let's talk about that more. But I would imagine that there's a number of public radio listeners that have maybe never heard either of Gucci Mane or heard his music. So let's take a listen to probably his most well-known track, which is Icy. What you do, because we icing, so icing, we icing, so icing. All these girls excited. So, McConan, I think Regina is over there giggling because she can't believe we're playing that on public radio. But okay, so Lynn, let's talk a little bit about this, because one of the reasons we're talking about Gucci Mane is the fact that so many people in Atlanta and in the South and throughout the country point to him as such an influence. And McConan, you're one of those people, are you not?
Yes, I am.
What makes him so influential?
I guess because he represents for like a lot of people in the South, and I've just grew up in Atlanta knowing about him, but I know like his reach and his influence is all throughout the South. He keeps his relevancy from like staying connected with the times and supporting the new artists that are coming up rather than, you know, shunning them or trying to just ride their wave. He embraces them and, you know, like he just gives everybody a chance, you know what I'm saying? He's like here not just for himself. So that's what a big thing is. That's why he's still to be incarcerated, still has a huge influence and still is on the scene because he's for the scene and not just trying to be seen.
Well, there's a lot, Regina, in what McConan just said. And I wanted to play this clip from Gucci Mane himself in which he's talking about kind of what motivates him.
I've always been working to get to the point I am now to continue to put out music. It was always my goal, and it still is my goal, to get this point to do what I do now. Be a CEO of my own self, my own friends, my own family, and we make music and make millions of dollars. Do what I do it for.
I mean, Regina, we're talking about an artist who's been unbelievably prolific, just a massive number of, he's had solo albums on major labels, he's had solo albums that he released independently, he's had mixtapes, collaborative albums, that doesn't even include the number of guest appearances he's made. So I wonder how important, how significant is it that he works independently as opposed to only releasing things through the major record labels?
One of the reasons he's particularly important is we have to understand the way that hip-hop is consumed in this kind of contemporary moment, in this present moment, is that we have the internet, we have social media, we have these independent mediums that allow for us to be exposed to new artists and also those artists who are able to take advantage of production-wise and release-wise what that means. And I really think that, you know, Gucci Mane more than anybody is reflective of what that kind of ambition means, especially in a social media moment. I had a student that told me that Katy Perry's, what is it, Dark Horse, Magic Horse?
Yeah, Dark Horse, I think.
Dark Horse was trap, and I about had a panic attack and a heart attack in front of the classroom because I was like, what exactly made it trap? And they were just talking literally about the way that it sounded. And I found that problematic, especially.
Well, let me stop you here then, because can you then give us your definition of what defines trap music? Because I'm about to ask you about how Gucci Mane changed trap music. So let's, I guess, define our terms first. What is trap, according to you?
Well, trap, according to me, is a subgenre of hip-hop that came out of Atlanta that demonstrated drug culture specific to this an urban South.
Okay, so I'm going to take this to you, Makonnen, but let me play you this comment. Let's go to the hip-hop producer, Zaytoven. And he's speaking about Gucci Mane and his sort of position as sort of a founder of trap. Let's take a listen.
We respect Gucci so much because Gucci will bring everybody together. He the mayor, like, he's the main guy when you talking about trap music. That's who you want to hear. So everybody else is, you know, understudies and doing their thing, but he just like the big dog. And he putting on everybody, he giving everybody a shot.
Yeah.
So, Makonnen, how do you think Gucci, you agree with that? You'd call him the mayor of trap music.
Yeah, or the godfather for me. You know, like, but he is giving everybody a shot. He gives the producers a shot. I mean, like, countless producers have made great careers from, you know, Gucci Mane giving them a shot, as well as artists and as well as video directors and, you know, just everybody who's in the arts and being creative. Like, he's somebody that come around and give you a shot, and you, next thing you know, your stuff is on television, and then you have other big labels calling to work with you and stuff, and it all started from the opportunity right there with him.
That's Georgia-based hip-hop artist Makonnen and hip-hop scholar Regina Bradley. If you want to hear how prison affected Gucci Mane, listen to his latest album, Drop Top WAP. NPR Music hip-hop reporter Rodney Carmichael has this review.
My name is Rodney Carmichael, and I am hip-hop writer at NPR. Hi. Gucci Mane is a very provocative figure in hip-hop.
Metro Boomin wants some more.
Feeling like I took a perk, I'm at a loss for words. It's like I smoked a pound of herb, so please do not disturb. Feel like I
Gucci Mane's last year has been a year of redemption for him, I think. Drop Top WAP is his latest album. I really feel like it's his best post-prison album. There are a lot of songs that I like on the album. He has at least one painfully autobiographical song. So on Drop Top WAP, it's called Lost for Words. And unless you really listen, you'll almost miss how dark it is.
She took a mileage, she can't even throw it up on my chuck. Just my luck that I caught a slut. Can't even mutter. Fell asleep and woke up. What a model when you came. And she shaped like a Coke bottle. Baby, what's your name?
His flow is a lot more playful and nursery rhyme melodic. But then you listen and you realize that he's really describing what it was like living in such a drug-addled state that he almost lost his mind and could have lost his life.
One day I may not wake up. A description of a young black man tripping with a pistol. Wanna kill monkey nuts on a Glock 40. I can go gorilla. So off point, he said 12 coming. I didn't peep the signal. I'm feeling like I
You hear a lot of repentance in a lot of these songs. And it's not to us, the listeners, like, he's definitely not apologizing for who he is by any means, but I think that Gucci is trying to reconcile this destructive person that he used to be with the better person that he's trying to be. And that's kind of hard to do when so much of the image that you've constructed for yourself is built on that reputation.
Like I drunk a pint of syrup, which snorted a half a bird. Can't even find the words, I'm so at a loss for words.
Huh. I like a song titled Dance with the Devil for similar reasons, because I think he has such a level of self-consciousness or self-awareness, and he's really exposing that in some of these songs. So this song is a really provocative song.
Hello, Metro on that beat.
100 grand, I'll make a nigga cool, wanna dance with the devil. Get the gloves in the shelf, he tryna dance with the devil. A ghetto superstar makeup, you wanna dance with the devil.
As the title suggests, you know, obviously Dance with the Devil is not a new concept, but as the title suggests, he's kind of talking about the ways that we like to flirt with danger, right? And he's asking, what is it that attracts us to the dark side? And he's asking, and he's posing this question to himself, but he's also using illustrations of, you know, be it fans or, you know, people that he comes across, or, you know, being a former drug dealer and, you know, that whole lifestyle and how attractive it can be sometimes.
I make them shoot you clean in your dad hat. Catch you at your truck and shoot you clean out your haircut. Everybody wanna be the kingpin, man. The feds snatched them up, now we ain't seen this man. 2017, everybody get high. Take a street drug.
Just talking about how we're pulled and attracted to the dark side. He has a line in the song where he says, in every neighborhood, there's a Gucci. The neighborhood dealer with an Uzi.
In every neighborhood, there's a Gucci. The neighborhood dealer with a Uzi. Baby started off right as a good girl. Now she trying to act hard like a hood girl.
It starts to reveal this kind of undercurrent. Again, going back to that thing that we don't necessarily like to acknowledge or look at, but we know is always there. You know, a lot of times we like to kind of refer to, you know, we put a mask on it, right? We say, oh, that's the boogeyman, and don't look over there and that kind of thing. But you know how that is when you're a kid and you're growing up, that's the thing that makes you more attracted to that thing. So he's kind of looking at the psychology behind what attracts us to the dark side. It's kind of an interesting song.
A ghetto superstar make on a dance with the devil. When she glance at the bells, she wanna dance with the devil.
I think that a lot of what Gucci is doing and what Gucci represents now resonates with me as an Atlantan. I think, you know, from Gucci's lens, it's the city, it's the town that he grew up in. It's blacker, it's a truer reflection of the culture that has defined where he's from. And that East Atlanta has been overlooked and has now been overrun by people who are not from that environment, that neighborhood, and they look down on people who are. I think it's an irony, an interesting irony that, you know, is not unique to Atlanta. He represents that harsh reality that we don't like to look at, but I think the have-nots, in a lot of ways, are as much a part of any capitalist society as the 1% are. And Gucci is an example of the have-nots selling their story for a change.
That's NPR hip-hop reporter Rodney Carmichael reviewing the latest album from Gucci Mane. It's called Drop Top Wop. Just ahead, the break room wonders if Stone Mountain is really Atlanta's best landmark. But first, telling history without words. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Atlanta's role in the civil rights movement is well known and well documented in print, on film and tape, and in photographs and letters. Historian Karshik Sims Alvarado has edited many of those photographs into a new book, Atlanta and the Civil Rights Movement from 1944 to 1968. We asked her to describe one photo that she thinks captures the movement.
Hi, my name is Karshik Sims Alvarado. Well, this book is a pictorial history. I call it a portable exhibition. I thought about putting together a book that allows people to be able to have the access to museums, but in a book form. And here we began to see all throughout the book faces of people that we would normally see or even mention when we start talking about the civil rights movement. One photograph that was really intentional in regards to his placement within the book is the very first photograph that you see in the opening chapter. I opened the book with an image of the 1944 voter registration campaign organized by African Americans in the city. In this black and white image, you see a woman front and center, and she is being sworn in as a registered voter, followed by thousands of blacks who packed the Fulton County Courthouse and lined the city streets over a course of 3 days to register and prepare themselves to vote in the upcoming white primary election on July 4th, Independence Day, 1944. The 5,000 black voters, compared to 6,000 white voters, were hoping to test the Smith decision where the U.S. Supreme Court ordered that it was unconstitutional to prevent anyone from voting in any election. Also within this image, unfortunately, blacks in the city were denied the opportunity to vote because their names were not listed on the voting rolls. And this sounds all too familiar to African Americans even today. The following election and every election afterwards, African American voters in Atlanta grew and they were able to determine and influence the election of local, state, and even presidential elections moving forward because they recognize their organization and voting strength. And that's what this photograph actually shows. This is why the image is so important to this book, because it documents the beginning of the modern civil rights movement in Atlanta 20 years prior to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it highlights what makes African Americans in Atlanta so exceptional in their quest for civil rights. There are a lot of lessons that we can learn in looking at this book. We're at a tough place in this country. I would consider to be at a crossroad of which direction we want to move in. And I think in this book, it is a blueprint, and that it shows you how we can become empowered, how we can organize ourselves. And with this particular group of individuals that's highlighted, you see them use what little resources they have available to them in order to become empowered. There's so many social movements that are going on right now, and we're all trying to get to a certain place where we can live cohesively. This book leads us in the right direction. There are a lot of things that we can pull from, that we can borrow or even mirror.
You just heard Kashik Sims Alvarado describing a photo from her new book, Atlanta and the Civil Rights Movement from 1944 to 1968. She'll appear at a signing tomorrow at 11 at the Atlanta History Center. You know what? It's been a long week. We've talked about voting rights, segregated schools, George's very own sad clown. So as we do every Friday, we've got a group of smart people with us. We're going to kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened since Monday. It's time for the break room.
We didn't know if there were other shooters that had us surrounded and would come into the dugout. So we didn't know whether to run or not.
It wasn't because we don't share your abhorrence of racism, and especially the particularly vicious form of racism that has manifested itself in the alt-right movement.
It's the city of Atlanta saying the LGBTQ community is part of our story, it's part of who we are, and it's here to stay.
Joining us in the break room this week, Sam Burnham. He curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Tamika DePriest is Senior Director of Communications at Emory University. Jessica Lee Libos is Community Editor for Connect Savannah. And special guest joining us from Macon is NPR business correspondent Sonari Glinton. Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hey. Sonari, what are you doing in Macon?
I have this tremendous opportunity to hang out with a bunch of high school students, two separate sets of them, one at Otis Camp, which is a camp that's every year. It's in its 10th year in Macon. The family of Otis Redding, the foundation, runs a music camp for high school students. And then separately, the Center for Collaborative Journalism has a high school camp for young people who want to, who think that journalism might be a career for them. And unlike so many of my colleagues, I don't want to discourage them. I want to encourage as many people to get into journalism as possible. It's a part of my thing. I work significantly with Youth Radio, NPR's, which is a separate organization from NPR, but it's they're our youth desk. So it's a great opportunity to be here. It's one of the most amazing weeks I've had in a very long time.
Well, we are happy to have you here in Georgia and hope you are enjoying the heat. anyhow, let's get on to some sort of serious news here. We talked earlier this week about lead contamination in Georgia's water systems. This issue, of course, first got national headlines because of the crisis in Flint, Michigan. So this week, five current and former Michigan health officials were charged with involuntary manslaughter because of a Legionnaires' disease outbreak that ended up killing 12 people. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette says the charges involve restoring public trust.
This investigation is about the families of Flint, the moms and dads who wanted to give their child a cool drink of water yesterday. It was 90 degrees, but didn't because they were fearful of the water.
So do we think these charges are warranted, or is this prosecutorial overreach?
Well, I used to be a reporter in Michigan, and I was based as the auto reporter in Ann Arbor. And I have to say, it is the general anger and sadness and frustration in Flint that goes back decades is... I mean, really, 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 people feel there that they have been completely left behind, not just by the state of Michigan and by the U.S. And that they really, people really, really wanted answers. And when I visited there, they wanted someone to pay a price. Now, I don't know of how whether or not it's, you know, everyone else thinks so. But if you're in Flint, Michigan, I really do think that the people think that someone needed to be prosecuted.
This was a... failure, leadership failure at an epic level, and etched on top of this sort of history that Sonari just pointed out. And there were just several instances over time where organizations and scientists and individuals tried to give Flint leadership, including the governor and those over the Environmental Quality Agency, signs that they were sort of sitting on, a really bad situation, and they were ignored and discounted. And so, it may be prosecutorial overreach.
It's a hard word to say, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But I think it's warranted based on the fact that no one wanted to really step up and be accountable for it. And there are many fingers to point, or there's a finger to point at many people.
Sam or Jessica?
Well, I think that somebody has to be held responsible. Excuse me, sorry. But somebody has to be held responsible. This is a magnificent tragedy. And again, people were warned over and over again. It's not like these people didn't have the information that they needed to step in. What I kind of find just equally horrendous and evil around this story is that these five people are being prosecuted, but the governor is continuing to defend them. And I'm really a little disappointed that the prosecutions didn't reach all the way up. I feel that Governor Rick Schneider should really be held responsible for this
tragedy.
You think
he should be charged?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know what, exactly the charges are, but I think that some public call-out, I think some public responsibility somehow needs to be accountable.
I'm with Bernie Sanders. I think he should accept responsibility and step down.
Sam,
yes, ma'am.
You had something to say?
Well, my take on it is there are civil and criminal liabilities when you're entrusted with a public service, whether you're a fireman, a police officer, whether you're a water elected official. My question is manslaughter the right charge? Can they prove that this directly. There wasn't anything else factoring into Legionnaire's disease. I don't know enough of the details of the story to know for sure. But there is definitely a criminal and civil liability when you're entrusted with that level of responsibility for people's health and well-being. And I think there should be some repercussions from what happened.
All right. So speaking of legal problems, Michael Vick, his NFL career was certainly marred by legal trouble. He served 21 months in prison and then 2 months in home confinement for illegal dogfighting convictions. And he ended up back in the NFL.
Just having Michael Vick on the field, you want to know where everybody is at all times. And see, this is the beauty part about having a guy like Michael Vick on your team. You know that he's a threat to run the ball. You know that he can pass the ball.
Well, Vick retired this week with the Atlanta Falcons, and Falcon officials have compared him to Michael Jackson and Michael Jordan in terms of his impact on Georgia and Atlanta's culture. Do we buy this?
Can I? I'm sorry to speak up so quickly, but as a Chicagoan, only Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan, y'all. Only Michael Jordan.
Well, as a Californian, only Michael Jackson is Michael Jackson.
Well, it's challenging. It's been challenging for me to equate this to the level of Jordan or Jackson for many of the reasons that you have said, which is like it's like comparing an orange with apples. That said, his impact was huge, and it exceeded Atlanta nationally. It even catapulted the NFL. I agree with the notion that he has helped to elevate Atlanta on the sports marketing map.
And think about it.
I agree with Tamika.
Sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. I interrupted you before.
Oh, no. To think about it in an interesting way is it's like when I was a kid, there were not a lot of quarterbacks. There were just like the thing, black African-American quarterbacks. And the thing, the ways in which he changed the sport is just like an amazing for many of us.
I agree with that. I think that, there's no doubt that he is a phenomenal athlete, and he's changed the face of what who a quarterback is and what and who quarterbacks can be. But I don't know, the dog fighting thing is really hard to get over. It's a really hard thing to forgive. I mean, moral character is very important. You're talking about somebody who put jumper cables on a dog's ears and threw them in a pool. I mean, these are really horrendous charges that, yes, he paid his dues, he went to jail for it, but he has never publicly acknowledged or apologized for those specific acts. So I think that's always going to be part of his legacy.
I'm probably dating myself just a little bit to say that I don't know that he has the same impact even as Deion Sanders did when he was in Atlanta. But I think the dogfighting issue actually gives him an opportunity, and where he goes with it from here will determine what his impact will be on the culture of the area in the future. I don't know if he's there yet, but he has an excellent opportunity to get there.
I agree, and I have read where he's actually been sort of sharing his mistakes with youth.
Yeah.
Okay. Providing some examples of what to avoid, but also if you have failure in your life, how to begin the process of recovery.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on and talk about landmarks. I don't know how many landmarks you've had a chance to see, Sonari, but there was a recent
Rose Hill.
there's a recent poll in the AJC, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and they found that most people think the Stone Mountain is Atlanta's favorite landmark. So what do we think here? And let's actually go to you first, Sam. What's your favorite landmark in Atlanta?
Oh, my goodness. I absolutely love Oakland Cemetery. I think it is a fabulously upkept and preserved piece of Georgia and national history.
And peaceful.
And peaceful right there in the middle of town. And for a minute, you'll forget you're in, this big major metropolitan city. And then look up and boom, there's the skyline still. And it's just like a respite. So I don't know that Stone Mountain is particularly my pick for the biggie, but I could certainly understand with everything they have there why Atlantans would go there. There's so much to do for so many different interest levels.
Jessica?
Well, again, I don't live in Atlanta, and I've been there a few times. My favorite landmark is the Trader Joe's at Five Points, but we don't have Trader Joe's in Savannah, so I was trying to make a stop there.
That's not a landmark.
But you know, Stone Mountain is a Confederate landmark. It is inherently controversial. And I find it surprising considering how cosmopolitan and progressive most of Atlanta is, in my perspective, that this would be their favorite landmark. But again, you know, it's for a lot of people, it is about heritage and it is about this particular place. But, you know, my understanding is that it was a Native American landmark long
originally.
Before.
We've got about a minute left, so let me let Tamika and Sonari weigh in here.
I always wonder who's taking these polls. Like, are they through landlines or something?
sounds like she doesn't buy it.
But in terms of my own favorite landmark, I have two of them, the King Center. I always meet amazing people at the King Center when I visit, and the National Center for Civil and Human Rights.
Sonari?
I'm gonna say first the King Center. Last year I had a layover in Atlanta and I wanted to go to the King Center and everyone told me not to. It was on Martin Luther King's birthday and I was like, why not? And it was really to be there on that day really really just affected me. But also I would say really seriously that for me the Atlanta airport. is you know, on the way to heaven or hell, I'm sure that there's going to be a changeover in Atlanta.
All right, it is Friday. We're hanging out in the break room. Just ahead, we're going to talk about NBC's decision to air that Megyn Kelly interview with Alex Jones. Stay with us. This is On Second Thought.
Don't be discouraged. Oh, I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We are having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do every Friday. And my guests today are Tamika DePriest. She is at Emory University. Also, we have Jessica Lee Libos joining us from Savannah. She's the community editor for Connect Savannah. Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. And our special guest is NPR correspondent Sonari Glinton, who is in Macon right now. We want to say thank you, as we do every week, to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink. It is delicious. Find it online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, this week we had a couple more high-profile shootings across the country. One of them was at a baseball practice where Republican lawmakers were practicing for last night's game. Here is House Speaker Paul Ryan's response.
We are united. We are united in our shock. We are united in our anguish. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
Fortunately, the only person killed in that attack was the perpetrator, the gunman. But we wonder, does this Virginia shooting, because in this case it targeted and injured seriously some lawmakers, and then the one that followed in San Francisco, will this spark a new conversation about gun safety? Jessica, you want to start?
Well, I mean, we haven't finished the old conversation, and the new conversation we're gonna, people are wanting to talk about gun restrictions and gun safety, but I've always thought the most important conversation that we're not having about guns is manufacturing. We have 300 million guns in this country, with almost 8 to 12 million being manufactured every single year. Guns don't expire, guns don't go bad, and so every single one of those guns will continue to be accumulate, and more accumulation is going to mean more shooting. So until we address gun manufacturing, I'm not sure that any other law or any other conversation really matters.
Sam, I assume you're disagreeing.
I absolutely disagree. I think Congressman Mo Brooks said it best, and he was actually present for the shooting. We have inherent liberties in this nation, and the founders saw fit to include that as the second in the list that they set apart in the Bill of Rights, which was the agreement. If we were to join the colonies together in a republic, we were to have certain guaranteed rights, and that was one they felt was very important, and they had their reasons for that. And I think that we can't allow bad things to entice us to give up our rights as Americans.
Sonari, you're a journalist. You and I have seen a lot of this come and go. Do you think this will actually spark a new conversation?
Well, if however many school rooms of children you know, haven't changed the conversation, or previous Congress people being shot. You know, it, you wonder, like, what will spark the conversation. You always hear that, you know, maybe there's a new conversation, but then you go, oh, it's the same conversation that we've been having for the last, you know, 60 years.
At least, Tamika.
Yes, I think of it as an ongoing conversation, and I'm always curious as to how we juxtapose gun rights with gun safety. And I think the challenge is to try to untangle that. You know, just gun homicide, the gun homicide rate in the U.S. is 25 times higher than those in comparable nations. Okay, and that's according to a study by the Harvard School of Public Health and the University of Nevada, Reno. And I think that there's some, perhaps some lessons that we can learn, but this conversation is critical and must continue.
All right, let's talk about something a little more cheerful. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed says the city will make those rainbow crosswalks you might have seen at the corner of 10th and Piedmont a permanent fixture. That is something that Atlanta musician and LGBTQ advocate Sarah Rose has advocated for. She spoke with WSB-TVD.
There's one in Hollywood and one in San Francisco, but, you know, Atlanta's really the first in the South to have these. It's the city of Atlanta saying the LGBTQ community is part of our story, it's part of who we are, and it's here to stay.
So what do we think? Do you think this is just kind of a symbolic waste of paint, or is this an actual achievement? Go ahead.
As a gay man who lives in West Hollywood and walks across the rainbow flag to get to the grocery store fairly often, I have to say there is something, it's almost gets me choked up to think that there is, you know, that acceptance at a time when around the world where, you know, so many gay men and women are in danger, to know that even a crosswalk or a place might be safe for you is amazing. And I'm, like I said, I live in West Hollywood, so it's 42% gay men, and I still hear, you know, F-bombs thrown, around in the neighborhood, and there's still a long way to go. But to know that there's maybe a sliver that's safe must be amazing for people who live there.
I think it's wonderful, and as the parent of a happily gay son, every show of acceptance matters, and I think this is a form of public art, and I think it serves in the way it's supposed to. Savannah is actually a site of Georgia's oldest LGBT organization, the First City Network, and we've just opened our first LGBT center here after 20 years, and I would love to see a rainbow crosswalk across Bull Street, or I think that would be wonderful. I think it's
sends
a wonderful
message.
She says
hoping the Savannah mayor and city council
hello,
is listening.
Hello. Let's just get the doors open first.
I love the symbolism of this and the fact that the city of Atlanta has put a firm stake in the ground, that the city supports the LGBTQ community. And that's great. I wondered if also the idea of something at a MARTA station. So I have begun to think about additional ways
to waste paint. Yeah.
To waste
Sorry,
paint.
That's dismissive. But yeah,
or to enjoy paint.
Exactly. That's what paint's for.
But happy to see it happening here in Atlanta.
Sam, you haven't weighed in here.
Well, not to be Debbie Downer on this, but from personal experience, there was here in Rome, they painted up a crosswalk not for any kind of civil rights or political purpose, but just as public art, as Jessica said before, and actually planned on doing all of them down our historic Broad Street that way, and then found a study that said that the decorated crosswalks actually decrease driver visibility of people in the crosswalk. And from the opening segment of the show, I don't know that Atlanta needs any decreased visibility of pedestrians
and
crosswalks.
The opening segment where we don't stay in our lane, use our brakes or our turn
signal. Right. If this indeed poses a hazard for pedestrians, it may not be a waste of paint. It may just be a bad idea. But
it's an interesting thought. If all of you listeners out there want to weigh in there, you know how to reach us. You can find us on Twitter at OST Talk. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We are in the break room with Sam Burnham, who you just heard, Tamika DePriest, Jessica Lee Libos, and Sonari Glinton of NPR. All right, let's talk religion. The Southern Baptist Convention denounced white nationalism and specifically the alt-right movement this week. Trillia Newbill is part of the denomination's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. She's also African-American, and she spoke with NPR.
I think it's important that we take every opportunity to denounce and set ourselves apart from anything that is racist or that alienates our brothers and sisters in Christ who are people of color.
So a lot of the alt-right groups claim to be Christian-based. Do we think something like this could actually make a difference? Jessica?
Ah.
I admire this stance. I really, and it was voted for overwhelmingly. I mean, this is really taking a very bold stance against racism, against the alt-right, that this odious, awful thing that seems to be overtaking Christianity and people using Christianity. I'm not Christian, so I don't want to speak to it. But I also feel like, you know, Southern Baptists haven't always been known as the most inclusive people. And I think to make this statement is very, very powerful. And, you know, I don't know if dancing in mixed company is coming next, or, you know, I mean, or more, you know, or even a more progressive stances against tolerance and within the LGBT community and things like that. But I think it's a very, very positive move.
I think for an organization that was founded to support Christians who wanted to uphold slavery and did not rebuke sort of this scandalous past until 1995 with a formal apology, I think it's a major step for it. And also, it seems that the organization still has some way to go in terms of really building an inclusive community, but that they have taken steps and are taking steps toward that.
Good point.
Sam?
Well, they stumbled a little. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, they did stumble a little, which I think by, you know, not immediately, you know, taking up this measure when, you know, there were several other measures about, you know, where the faith stood that passed unanimously without, you know, any conversation. And that little stutter step shows the difficulty of healing these long-held wounds. I mean, people have talked here about making, you know, the one church that was divided, you know, between black and white and finally coming together. But they're actually just talking about coming together. You know, Saturday is, You know, Sunday's still the most segregated day of the week. It is an amazing thing. But, you know, to move forward, you have to acknowledge that it is a move forward. But notice that it was still a little difficult.
Okay, Sam?
Yeah, the SBC, and I was involved in it for, you know, at least in a member church for about 10 years. They've had this trend over the last 20 to 30 years, and I don't want to come across as cynical about it, but they've really stretched out as a form of growing their denomination into trying to attract more minorities into the SBC. And I don't know if that's necessarily what they're doing. As far as the effectiveness, Christianity has so many denominations. It has three major traditions between your Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant faith. And this is just one that's a drop in the bucket, whether it has an impact on those people. The SBC's reach is really only within its own denomination, and I don't know how effective that necessarily will be. Depends on how many of them are Baptists.
Okay, let's talk about TV news. NBC is getting a lot of pushback, complaints from advertisers. That's because of the choice to air an interview Megyn Kelly did with Alex Jones. Alex Jones is an extremist. He believes Sandy Hook was a false flag operation. He's actually insulted the grieving parents. He also believes 9/11 was an inside job.
When we question official stories where the system has the motive, the means, it basically stands to gain, that is patriotic thing to do, because if you're not aware of false flags, self-inflicted wounds, staged terror attacks, then you invite the system to do this.
Okay, so do we think NBC should air this interview or not? And I'm going to go to my fellow reporter first. Sonari?
Well, Megyn Kelly is a journalist and, you know, she talks to people and that is what we do. I think it's an, you know, he has influence on the West Wing. He has influence on a lot of people. And so I think it's an important viewpoint to hear from, you know, just because you have someone on your, you know, your radio show doesn't mean, or your TV show doesn't mean it's an endorsement. But, you know, we're here to disseminate information.
Tamika?
Well, they aired Megyn Kelly's interview with Putin. And so to me, it looks like Kelly and NBC are keen to link their brands with giving extremists a platform. They'll have to take the heat for doing so. And I, having been a journalist before I became a marketing communications person, do understand the fact that, you know, you don't censor out any part of the story or what's happening as it relates to news, right. and understand that that's also what Megyn Kelly and NBC are doing.
Sam?
I think he's sort of been elevated to newsworthiness. He is a freak, okay? I'm not justifying him at all. I hate that when he gets that conservative label stuck to him, because then I'm sitting there going, no, hey, whoa, no, don't look at me. I'm not like him. But at the same time, I think maybe it would be good. Let's drag him out in the light and let people see who he is, and know that when you see him tagged as mainstream, that no, he's just crazy. And we need to ignore him, and we need to be wary of anybody who might would retweet him or trust him or let him have any influence over anything they're doing.
Well, anybody who takes in InfoWars will know all of that, Sam.
That's right. Well, Jessica?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sound of Alex Jones' voice just gives me gastric issues. But, I mean, I agree that, you know, we'll see what happens after Sunday. I mean, I read this morning that they are... producers are still retooling and editing the interview. They have been they've amended it to include some of the Sandy Hook parents onto the show. So, you know, I think, you know, we make our choices as journalists on who we decide are going to get to tell their stories. And, you know, I don't know what impact this is going to have. I think it's going to be really interesting to see. I don't know that whether it's going to validate him or take him down, but, you know, a lot more people are going to have an opportunity to judge what they hear.
All right, let's go to a lightning round here. I mean, quick. From England, we got this story about a guy who called the police when he found out that his girlfriend and her cat had eaten all his bacon. He then told them he wanted to press charges against both of them, the girl and the cat. Okay, so here's the thing. Has the love for bacon gone too far? Tamika?
This is funny.
It's funny, but yes. Is it too far? Okay, Jessica?
Well, this is just not kosher at all, but, you know, no. I'm just pretty sure if you prosecute a cat, cats can't be reformed at all. I mean, you're going to put a cat in jail, it's just going to start a gang and, you know, underground bacon black market within the prison walls.
Cats are criminals. Okay, fair enough, Sam.
Bacon is supposed to be an affordable protein at breakfast to go with your biscuits. It's not supposed to be trendy and all this. No, it's gone too far.
And Sonari?
Are you going to prosecute a cat for being a carnivore? Really? Like, seriously?
Well, he wanted to. They don't actually charge cats, though. We are out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all my guests, Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Emory University Senior Director of Communications Tamika DePriest, Connect Savannah Community Editor Jessica Lee Libos, and NPR correspondent Sonari Glinton from Macon. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Happy Friday. You have a good day. Yeah.
And we would love to listen to hear from all of you out there listening. Has the love for bacon finally gone too far? Leave us a message or you can tweet at us at OST Talk. Find us on Facebook, however you do it. For today and the week, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.